This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Our first question comes from Jude Austin, who asks, if you sun on the surface of Mercury during the day, could you see the stars, or would the sun's brightness make this impossible?
Well, this is the kind of question that could keep a curious mind awake at night, doesn't it? Can you see the stars from Mercury during the day? Well, on Earth, the reason you can't see the stars during the day is because the light from the sun is diffused out and through the atmosphere, making the sky brighter than the stars. But Mercury has no atmosphere, so surely this wouldn't be a problem. But what about the Sun? The Sun on Mercury is really bright. It's about 7 times as bright as a sunny day on Earth. This means that the glare from the sunlight reflected off the ground would be stupendous. Even though Mercury's surface is about as black as coal, it'd be as bright as walking around in a snowfield in a clear day. You'd soon get snow blindness, if that's if you didn't cook first. You might be able to get around this slight inconvenience if you shielded your vision well enough so that you could only see the sky, but generally speaking, seeing the stars would be impossible. In fact, this was true of the Apollo astronauts visiting the moon as well. Most people don't realise that the moon is also about as black as coal, but it still reflected too much sunlight for the astronauts to see the stars from its surface. Now, I've had to do a bit of guesswork here, but I reckon that you have to go out at least as far as the moons of Uranus before you could stand on another piece of rock and see the sun and the stars at the same time. Even then, you'll have to shield the sun from your vision. You'd have to go about 100 times further than the Earth, about 2.5 times the orbit of Pluto, to be able to look back at the sun and see the stars with naked eye at the same time.
On the forum, Guelo asks, on average, each planet is 1.8 times further from the sun than its predecessor. Why?
Well, this is a variation of what we know as Bode's law. Put simply, it turns out the distance of the planets from the sun can be described very simply, even leaving a nice space in the middle for the asteroid belt to fit in. Now, we don't really know the reason for this. In fact, many astronomers just put down to sheer coincidence. But there are a few good ideas out there. Basically, it all boils down to the fact that once you've got planets, they can move each other around the solar system just through the gravity. Now, to illustrate this, let me take you back in time by 4.5 billion years. Imagine you're looking down the forming solar system. You see a feeble but growing young sun, surrounded by a spiralling disk of turbulent, churning gas and dust. In the denser parts of the disk, the dust is clumping together to form rocks, a bit like modern-day asteroids. Further out, where it's colder, the dust is mixing with ice to form dirty snowballs, a bit like modern-day comets, but without the tail. Now, we don't know why these regions were dense to start off with, but it might have something to do with the exact nature of the disk's turbulence and viscosity, in which case the spacing of the planets might already have been determined by this point. Now, these clumps grew as more stuff stuck to them. Eventually, they start attracting things around them through their own gravity, and that's when they start to become big, greedy bullies. Anything that's close to their orbit will be pulled in and gobbled up. As rocks grow into planets, they clear their orbits by pulling in all the other lumps of rock around them. Anything that's not pulled in will be spat out, ejected into interstellar space by a planet-sized gravitational slingshot. So there's little material left for other planets to grow in nearby orbits, and any that do are quickly dealt with by the Big Brother. Now, anything just out of reach of those planets can still be pulled around, and vice versa. If a forming planet's gobbled up all the rocks outside its orbit, for instance, it'll be gravitationally pulled towards the remaining rocks on the inside of its orbit, so its orbit will migrate inwards towards them. Even when they've gobbled up everything nearby, fully grown planets are still big bullies, and will be tugged towards neighbouring planets. This usually ends up with a smaller planet being gobbled up or thrown out the system. The best way for a planet to survive is to be forced into an orbit which doesn't tug in the same way on the other planets. It's called a resonant orbit. Neptune and Pluto are a good example of this, where Neptune's stronger gravity has forced Pluto into an orbit that's almost exactly 1.5 times longer than Neptune's. Jupiter's moon's another good example. And this is a more stable system, and is one of the few ways that planets and moons can live with each other in close proximity. But the real reason that our planets are spaced as they are is likely to be a combination of these effects. From the intrinsic size of turbulent cells in the forming solar system, to gravitational focusing and clearing of orbits in the forming planetary system, coupled with orbital forcing and migration of planets into resonant orbits. Now, we're not really sure which of these is most important in giving us the planets we see today, but undoubtedly we'll learn more about it as we explore other planetary systems and see how they differ from our own.
Our next question comes from Francis Day, who says, I just saw a NASA video about the new findings from Voyager of what happens where the solar wind hits the interstellar medium. I'm puzzled about why there's a shockwave.
Okay, there's two interesting points regarding this question that not everyone will know. Firstly, did you know that the sun's on a diet but still getting fatter? And did you know that, in space, people can hear you scream, but you have to do it really loudly. So what do I mean by this? Well, firstly, the sun's losing mass. I'm not just talking about light from the sun. Using E equals mc², we can work out the sun loses about 4 million tons every second by producing light. But there's also about 1.5 million tons every second of the sun's atmosphere that gets thrown off into space. You see, the sun's outer atmosphere is a tangled web of magnetic fields that confine charged particles and heat them up to millions of degrees. We can see the bottom of these magnetic fields as sunspots. Gradually, the magnetic fields can be squeezed together until the sunspot bursts. And we all know what happens when spots burst, and it's not pleasant.
Ooh. Thank you for that visualization.
You're welcome. The release of pressure makes the confined matter explode away from the sun's surface in a solar flare at about 1 million miles an hour. So over time, the sun loses a lot of weight, but ironically, changes in its internal structure means it's still getting bigger, so its diet isn't really working. But what happens to this material, these particles, when they're released from the sun? Some of them hit the Earth's magnetic field, where they can destroy satellites, cause aurorae, and occasionally, fry the Canadian mains power supply. But the Earth is pretty insignificant to the cosmos, so the vast majority of these particles end up flying off into space. But contrary to popular opinion, space isn't empty. It's just nearly empty. And there are occasional atoms and molecules and dust grains flying around in it. There's not many of these, but interstellar space is also very big. So in total, there's enough of this interstellar medium to make a big difference. These particles are sitting there, minding their own business, when along comes this dense wave of particles from the sun and slams into them.
So, in the amount of particles there is, I've read somewhere it's one particle per cubic metre.
Yep, that's about right.
So if you imagine the cupboard under the stairs and sort of think about two particles in there, then that's what the density of the interstellar medium.
That's about right, so it doesn't need very much dusting. Now, we're used to pressure and density waves like this in normal situations, but we call them sound waves, and that's exactly what this is. The sound of the explosion on the sun is transmitted in the ejected material and out into the interstellar medium. Only because of the distance the sound has to travel, and the exquisite tenuousness of the gas, rather than the deafening boom that you would hear on the sun's surface, you would only have an inaudible boom. So if you did scream in space, you could be heard, but only if you had lungs more powerful than the sun and ears big enough to hear it. So we've established that when the material from the sun hits the interstellar medium, the interstellar medium experiences the sound of the sun's explosions. But a normal sound wave doesn't create a shock wave, so why is it the sun? The key difference here is the speed. Particles in the gas move around at about the speed of sound. That means that if something's moving slowly through a gas, the particles it hits can signal the particles further ahead and say, "Hey guys, get out of the way, there's something coming." If something's moving through the gas faster than the speed of sound, the particles further ahead never get this information. They don't know what's about to happen, and so, not surprisingly, they get a bit shocked when they get hit. Thus, we have a shockwave. Now, we're used to seeing this kind of shockwave as a sonic boom from aircraft or from explosions. Now, if you cast your mind back, I said that material left the sun at about 1 million miles an hour. Now, this is much faster than the speed of sound in typical conditions in space, so it creates a sonic boom ahead of it. And all these millions of explosions that are going off in the sun's atmosphere are creating shockwaves that hit the interstellar medium. The force of these shocks pushes the interstellar medium away like a snowplow. But the shockwave around the sun, which we call the heliopause, is standing still. So why doesn't it just keep travelling? Well, there's another factor here. The sun is also travelling through the local neighbourhood at about 40,000 miles an hour compared to the gas around us, which means that the expanding wave of solar ejecta and piled up interstellar medium is pushed ahead of us in that direction. Eventually, enough interstellar gas gets piled up ahead of the shock to start pushing back, and the shockwave slows down to a standstill. This means that there's a stationary shock between the solar wind pushing in one direction and the interstellar medium pushing back in the other, giving us the heliopause. It sits at something like 3 times the distance of Pluto in the direction the sun's travelling, but in the opposite direction the heliopause can expand freely, which means it has a teardrop shape. Now, believe it or not, this is a simplified version of what's going on. If you want to know more, Wikipedia has a good article about the heliosphere that you can investigate yourself.
So we'll link to that article on the show notes. It sounds like there's a lot of complicated physics in action going on here.
You wouldn't believe it.
Our final question comes from Peter Ellinger, who asks, "Dark energy is the name given to the phenomenon causing the expansion of the universe. The following train of thought comes to mind. If E equals mc², then, as a star shines, the mass of the universe decreases, so gravity decreases, so the universe will expand faster. Do the sums add up? If not, where am I going wrong?"
Okay, if you're still keeping up here, it's an intriguing thought. Nuclear fusion converts mass into energy. and so the universe has less mass in it as stars shine, and less mass produces less gravity to hold the universe together. Meanwhile, there's this mysterious force called dark energy, which is causing the universe to expand faster and faster. Are the two linked? In short, no, and that's for two reasons. Dark energy makes up about 72% of the universe, with dark matter making up another 23%, so it's kind of embarrassing that we don't really know what either is. The stuff that we can see in the universe, baryonic matter, makes up about 4.6% of it, and only about 5% of that is in stars at any one time. Of the entire history of the universe, only 0.08% of that mass has been converted into light. So the energy that is in light is therefore only a few millionths of dark energy in the universe. So I'm afraid your sums don't add up. The other spanner I have to put in the works is that even though matter has been converted into light, that light still produces gravity. Now Einstein's E equals mc squared means that we can think of matter as merely being like a rechargeable battery of energy. You can store energy as matter. But Einstein's work doesn't just inform us that mass can be transformed into energy and vice versa. It means that mass and energy are entirely transmutable. Now we're used to thinking of light as consisting of massless photons. In fact, it merely has no rest mass. Not that we can ever bring a photon to rest to measure it. The energy a photon carries gives it an effective relativistic mass that causes gravity. Thus, even as the universe's matter is converted into light, the amount of energy, and therefore the amount of gravity in the universe, doesn't change. So, Peter, I'm sorry to spoil your idea, but at least you can rest in the knowledge you've given us something interesting to think about.
Thanks to Jude Austin, Qualio, Francis Day, and Peter Ellinger for their questions. And if you have a question you'd like to put to Ask an Astronomer, you can get in contact via the normal methods.